Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses the significance of Spain's recent parliamentary election, where the anti-austerity Podemos party upended the nation's two-party system. Daniel Jacobson of the group Environment California, who talks about a massive methane gas leak in Southern California that's both a public health and climate disaster. And Sean McElwee of Demos and professor of political science Jason McDaniel, who examine the question of how the Fox News Channel's coverage influences its viewers' attitudes on race. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While wars rage on in Iraq and Syria, pitting the Islamic State against the West and moderate Arab nations, a non-political path for Islam is growing in the face of violence inspired by ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other jihadists. Dawah and Tabligh, a nonviolent movement that began in British colonial India, now has over 50 million followers, mostly in the volatile Middle East. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the movement successfully gains new followers by proselytizing door-to-door in over 200 countries, including the U.S. In Egypt, Dawah has gained millions of followers after the downfall of the Muslim Brotherhood and the jailing of its former president and Brotherhood leader, Mohamed Morsi. While other Islamist groups are now banned in Egypt, Dawah has prospered by staying out of politics. Still, some observers question the nonviolent nature of Dawah. Richard Reid, the so-called shoe bomber, belonged to Dawah in Britain before he attempted to detonate explosives hidden in his shoe while on a 2001 flight headed toward the United States. The Economist magazine reports that Ethiopia is undergoing a demographic transition as population growth stabilizes in urban areas and contraception is used more widely in rural agricultural communities. Over the last generation, Ethiopia's fertility rate has fallen dramatically, and the population in the East African nation is expected to peak at the end of the 21st century. Unlike South Asia and Latin America, however, population growth in sub-Saharan Africa is still higher than projected by demographers at the UN. Global population is expected to peak at 11.2 billion people by 2100, with Africa projected to be home to 4.4 billion people, who will face the threats of disease, war, and famine. By the end of the century, half of the most populous nations will be on the African continent: Nigeria, Congo, Tanzania, Ethiopia, and Niger. The positive population trends in Ethiopia were a result of the government's decision to fund a network of 38,000 health extension workers, one for every 2,500 people. The health workers go door-to-door in villages and provide advice on immunizations, hygiene, and family planning. But to be effective, contraception must be accessible and cheap. 3 years ago, Western donors pledged $2.6 billion to promote contraception. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is now spending $140 million annually on family planning, where 24 million women now have access to affordable contraceptives. Activists led by the African Black Coalition, or ABC, have convinced the University of California system to divest $25 million from its endowment's investment in private prison firms like Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA. The University of California now becomes the second university after Columbia to divest funds from private prison companies. Activists are pledging to keep up the pressure on the University of California until it withdraws its holdings from Wells Fargo Bank, which has issued a $900 million line of credit to CCA. Yoel Haile, political director of the ABC, who represents Black student unions across the UC system, declared, "This victory is historic and momentous. Divesting $25 million is a good step towards shutting down private prisons by starving them of capital." Coalition organizer Camila Moore stated, "We will continue to call for the complete divestment, including transparency and reinvestment in education and businesses owned or controlled by the formerly incarcerated." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
In Spain's December 20th parliamentary election, voters sent a clear message to the nation's two major political parties, rejecting the policies of the past as they signaled their yearning for new leadership. While the ruling Conservative People's Party won the most seats, followed by the opposition Socialist Party, the surprise third-place finish of the new anti-austerity leftist Podemos Party upended Spain's conventional politics. Another new party, the business-friendly Ciudadanos or Citizens Party, came in fourth place. Podemos was born less than 2 years ago in March 2014, after massive protests erupted across Spain against staggering unemployment, rising inequality, and corruption. The party, led by Pablo Iglesias, a 37-year-old professor, offered voters a program that opposes Eurozone austerity measures, advocates measures to increase employment and public investment in education, as well as progressive tax reform. With no party holding a majority in Spain's parliament, negotiations have begun to form a new coalition government. However, Podemos has ruled out talks to form an alliance with larger parties, and instead is proposing a social emergency law that would prevent families from being evicted for not paying their mortgage and provides resources to retirees so they can afford to buy medicines. Your reporter spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who examines the significance of Spain's election results and the economic conditions that explains why voters effectively ended Spain's two-party system.
The main significance is that the economic policies of the Eurozone and European authorities, which include the European Central Bank, the Eurogroup of Finance Ministers, the IMF, and the European Commission, those have really failed in Europe. Europe has, you know, the Eurozone has more than twice the unemployment than we do, and they don't have a lot of hope for the future. I mean, Spain itself has about the second largest, right after Greece, unemployment rate, highest unemployment rate in the world for a high-income country or developed country. They got 21.6% unemployment, 47% for youth, 60% of the unemployed have been out of work for more than a year, so they're long-term unemployed, people leaving the country, searching for work. So this is what the vote is in response to, even though, you know, the media has been trying to make a big deal out of the Spanish economy having grown, projected to grow 3.1%. for 2015, but the growth is too slow. Even, you know, if you project out, it's too slow to really bring the economy anywhere near reasonable levels of employment in the foreseeable future. In fact, if you look at the IMF projections, they're saying that even when the economy reaches its full potential, that is its potential GDP, you're still going to have 16.5% unemployment. So that's not really a future, and that's why people are voting against the government, even though it's in an economic recovery. And this is a problem for the whole Eurozone. Obviously, it's different. It's not the whole Eurozone. Obviously, Germany is doing okay and some other countries. But overall, the Eurozone is in trouble because the policies have been wrong since the Great Recession.
Mark, what new proposals does Podemos bring to the debate in Spain about future economic policy changes?
Oh, they have a lot of new proposals. I mean, their main thing is employment. They want to stimulate the economy. They want to have a sustainable debt, so they're willing to raise taxes, especially on the upper income groups, because the distribution of income has worsened quite significantly since the Great Recession, since 2009. You know, Spain is still far behind everyone in Western Europe and the Eurozone in terms of the amount of money that the government spends on social welfare, except for Ireland. This is a legacy of the 40 years of dictatorship. So they want to have a modern state. They want to restructure the economy to, you know, make it more competitive internationally, but not by pushing wages down, which has been the actual strategy, the so-called internal devaluation strategy of the European authorities, is that because you're in this common currency and you can't devalue or let the currency depreciate in order to become competitive, in order to recover when you're in with the austerity, the budget tightening, shrinking the economy, you have to actually reduce the real value of the currency by pushing your wages and labor costs down and pushing prices down. And that's why they've had this terrible recession and this even much more terrible levels of unemployment. So Podemos proposes rather to grow their way towards greater levels of employment rather than trying to push wages down to the level where you could get this mythical export-led growth strategy that brings prosperity to everyone, which hasn't really happened.
Mark, do election results like we've seen here in Spain with the rise of the anti-austerity Podemos party and the rise of the Syriza party in Greece, as well as a coalition government in Portugal that also is anti-austerity, is there any reason to think that the views in Berlin or across Europe are going to be changing anytime soon because of the rise of these new anti-austerity parties?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a big question. Their views are changing, but much too slowly. They're changing in the sense of the European Central Bank has engaged in quantitative easing a couple of years after the United States did it. That lowered interest rates and probably contributed to the depreciation of the euro against the dollar, which helped contribute to the little bit of recovery that Spain has had. So you do see change, but it's way too slow. It's certainly too slow for Greece and for Spain with the mass unemployment that they have, and for Portugal. So that is the question. Will they change enough so that the Eurozone economies can get to some reasonable levels of employment where young people have a future? It doesn't look like it yet. So the question is, you know, how will this end? Will Europe change? Will the European authorities remain like they are and you'll have a more unequal, somewhat poor Europe with higher levels of unemployment indefinitely? Or will somebody like Spain or Greece end up leaving the euro and others follow? That's the question we don't know yet.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose new book is titled Failed, What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. Find more analysis on the Spanish election results by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On October 23rd, a large plume of methane gas began leaking from a ruptured well pipe owned by Southern California Gas Company in the upscale community of Porter Ranch, 23 miles northeast of Los Angeles. The leak is fed by the second largest gas storage site in the U.S. at Aliso Canyon that serves 21 million customers. Although methane itself is invisible and odorless, chemicals are added to the gas to give it a telltale smell so it can be detected in the case of leaks. Viewed through an infrared camera, the gas can be seen pouring into the atmosphere. Many area residents have been suffering from nausea, headaches, vomiting, and other ills since the leak began. The gas company is paying for hotel stays for thousands of residents while it works to fix what has become both a huge public health and climate disaster. Half a dozen attempts to kill the well have failed, and the company is now drilling a new well to try to safely divert the gas. The methane leak so far accounts for 25% of the state's total annual methane releases and is undoing much of the state's groundbreaking efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Methane is 86 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than the much more plentiful carbon dioxide in the first 20 years after release, a critical time period for the urgent efforts now underway to get climate change under control. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Daniel Jacobson, legislative director with the group Environment California, who talks about the disaster and why it hasn't received the media attention of the last enormous fossil fuel-related disaster, the massive Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010.
Photography and the graphics and the pictures coming out of Deepwater Horizon were scary and startling. I mean, the deaths that were involved, hundreds of millions of gallons of oil that was leaking into the Gulf, the animals that were getting sick and coated in oil, the oil that was washing up on the beaches, that's what was being shown all over the world. This problem is just as great, except instead of black oil oozing onto our beaches, we've got methane gas, which is more potent than CO2, oozing into our atmosphere and causing both a public health nightmare, but also a global warming catastrophe. The amount of methane that is escaping is enough to fill the Empire State Building every single day, which is a startling amount, but will end up being 25% of California's methane emissions for the year. This is a state that needs to become a world leader in reducing global warming pollution. And we know that pollution like methane and other short-lived climate pollutants are significantly more harmful to global warming than even CO2.
Even though the national media doesn't seem to have picked up on the seriousness of this disaster, is it a big deal to people in California?
Oh, yeah. This is a huge story statewide, and even one of our most credible newspapers in the state and probably the country, the Los Angeles Times, has called on Governor Brown to shut down aging facilities like this because we just can't do both those things, both be a climate leader and at the same time continue to allow this kind of accidents to happen or continue to be the third largest oil producing state in the country. Those two things are not consistent. And if we want to be a leader in solving climate change, we're going to have to stop storing things like natural gas and stop drilling for oil.
So this is a privately owned facility. Can state government do anything to move this process along to stop the leak?
Well, it'll be difficult to get it fixed faster. I think just reported that the gas company has finally figured out where the leak is coming from. You know, that was really one of the scariest things, is that they didn't even know where it was. And now that they know where it was, they can begin the very long process of trying to figure out how to stop it. It's expected to take through the end of March. And so people who live in that area are going to be displaced. They're going to suffer the impacts of overexposure to methane and to some of the other gases that are put into natural gas to warn us of the dangers, ironically, of when they're there.
Dan Jacobson, what are local residents saying and doing about this? I know the gas company is paying $250 a day to relocate families away from the leak, many of whom are suffering health impacts like nausea, dizziness, and rashes. More than 2,600 families have asked to be relocated.
The local citizens are outraged. Many of the citizens didn't even know that they live so close to a natural gas storage facility. And what they're really demanding is, we want to make sure that we get relocated to places that are safe. We want to make sure that our kids are safe and that there's no schools that are being impacted by this. If there's any loss of value to our property because of this, they want to be compensated for it. And, you know, they're also wanting to make sure that these kinds of accidents don't happen to them in the future or to anybody else in the state of California.
I read that there are 100 other gas wells in the immediate area. I wonder what's the likelihood of more disasters like this.
Well, it's hard to say exactly how likely it is to happen again, but what we're talking about here is fossil fuels. And the thing that we know is, when you try to either dig up fossil fuels or drill for them or frack for them or transport them, that there's going to be accidents. And there always have been, and there always will be. And the storage, which is what we're talking about here, the storage of this natural gas, we just can't do it safely for a long time. And that's what's happening here, is we've got a very old facility whose pipes are cracking and literally bursting at the seams. And it's causing an environmental nightmare and a public health nightmare for the people who live around there. And the only way that we're really going to be able to solve this problem is to move away from fossil fuels and to move toward renewable energy like wind and solar.
That was Daniel Jacobson, legislative director with the group Environment California. For more information on the health and climate impact of the massive Southern California methane leak, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Ever since Barack Obama was elected president in 2008, the Republican Party has prosecuted a fierce political war against America's first black head of state. The Tea Party movement that emerged after the 2008 election attracted many activists that espoused blatantly racist views, bigoted messaging clearly seen and heard in their crude rhetoric and on their protest signs and websites, accusations that Barack Obama wasn't an American citizen, and charges that he lied about his Christian religion and was actually a Muslim, were all designed to undermine and discredit the new president as he entered the White House. The Republican Party all but officially endorsed these baseless charges, with many prominent GOP legislators stating they had no idea if the president was a citizen or not when asked by the media. Fox News, long established as a mouthpiece for the Republican Party apparatus, incorporated these storylines into much of their programming. With their long-running bias in covering issues and events involving race, the news channel has gained a well-deserved reputation over the years as a friendly home for viewers who hold racist views. Now, a new study has been published that substantiates the view that whites who regularly watch Fox News are more likely to express attitudes of symbolic racism and racial resentment than those who don't. The investigation conducted by Sean McElwee, research associate at Demos, and Jason McDaniel, assistant professor of political science at San Francisco State University, was recently published under the title, Do Racists Like Fox News, or Does Fox Make People Racist? Your reporter spoke with McElwee and McDaniel, who summarized their disturbing findings.
There's been a lot of real surge, according to some great research by some colleagues of mine, in the kind of racial resentment or symbolic racism since the election of Obama. A lot of documentation about how people are more likely than to not only express racial resentment, but also what we call old-fashioned racism, that idea that blatant stereotyping. So there has definitely been a rise in those kinds of attitudes. And then the question is that related to the change in the media environment as well, especially, you know, the Fox News media environment? And so I thought it was a really fascinating question, and it was really fun to try to look at some of the data.
Professor McDaniel, can you summarize for us the most compelling evidence you found that viewers of Fox News are more likely to adopt attitudes on race that many of us would likely disagree with?
For me, the one that really gets at it is this idea of the question of asking people, you know, should blacks just try harder to get ahead, right? So it's this question that really is trying to get Americans' attitudes about being an immigrant nation and getting individualism, and that this, you know, these stories, these narratives, if not these myths of how other ethnic groups immigrated to the country, came here and worked without sort of affirmative action, without help from the government, so to speak, or special favors. And it's one of those questions that a lot of our political scientists like to get at, because it reveals the sense of, when people think about racial inequality, do they then see it as a matter of inherent connected to race, or is it about structural conditions that we can maybe do something as a society, or have a duty to do something as a society to overcome? And what we see is that, you know, on average, Democrats are much less likely to agree with that statement, right? That they're more likely to see that there's, you know, structural racism present and that government can do something about that, or maybe we should do something about it, where Republicans are much more likely to think that the government shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't ask the government to do something, that's a matter of individualism. But when we compare Fox News watchers, what we see is that Democrats basically become just like Republicans, right? Those Democrats who watch Fox News become indistinguishable in their attitudes from those Republicans who watch Fox News or don't. So it seems to be, you know, almost as strong, if not stronger, than the idea of one's party attachment on this particular issue. And I think that has some pretty profound consequences for racial dialogue and racial politics in the country.
Sean, in doing the research you did for this article, I know it's almost impossible to test the content, the individual content of individual shows and hosts, but what is it about the content on Fox News that you think makes the difference in racial attitudes from Fox viewers to non-Fox viewers?
Right. There actually is a variable in the American National Election Studies data set that we looked at that looks exactly at Bill O'Reilly's show specifically. But one of the things that I actually asked Jason to go back and sort of run is this stereotyping about Muslims and stereotyping about whether or not President Obama was born in the United States. It was stunning that, you know, Democrats who watch Fox News are more likely to say that Obama isn't born in the United States. And there is a statistically significant effect on the Muslims are violent stereotyping. And if you sort of look at the coverage that Fox News has, you know, sort of the birtherism and of the stereotyping about Muslims, particularly, you know, with the stuff like the Ground Zero Mosque, that was a sort of political controversy that was essentially created by Fox News. That's one keynote. And the other keynote to remember is, even if Fox News, like, isn't making people racist, the fact that people who have, like, racially charged views are going to Fox News tells you something about their coverage. And I just want to finally note that there are a lot of studies suggesting that what essentially academics have done is looked at Fox News's rollout. Right now it's a national network, but as it was rolling out, it started rolling out in specific media markets at different times. And what they found is that when Fox News rolled out in a media market, it actually had a statistically significant effect on vote shares for Republicans and even how Democrat and Republican members voted. So if Fox News can change electoral and legislative outcomes, I don't see why it couldn't also change viewers' attitudes about core questions about what it means to be American and race in America.
And if I could add to that, I think what happens, what we see is that, you know, most people are not thinking about issues of race every day, right? And so when you ask them about it, they often will think about something that's on the top of their head or their most recent sort of memory or experience of a racial issue or something, some encounter, what have you. And I think what is possible is that Fox News and other kinds of things sort of prime people to think a certain way, you know, about what's important when it comes to race, right? So I think when Fox News will, its racial coverage tends to choose a frame that's about the undeserving other, right? Race then is about going against the American ideal of hard work and individualism and the American dream, and instead it's about those who are getting benefits that we're not getting or that they're undeserving of those benefits, the sort of, you know, welfare queen, the classic Reagan imagery there. I think that's how the content tends to work. It's framing it in those undeserving ways, those anti-American ways.
That was Sean McElwee, research associate at Demos, and Jason McDaniel, assistant professor of political science at San Francisco State University, authors of a new study titled "Do Racists Like Fox News, or Does Fox Make People Racist?" Find links to their article and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.